You guys ready? Let's shift gears a little bit. Now that you've been stimulating muscarinic receptors, what happens if you take an extract of this beast? This is Atropa belladonna, otherwise known as atropine. It's not the best picture in the world, but it's the one we got. Atropa belladonna, they used to take the berries from this plant, the seeds. Down here you can see a nice black berry. They'd make a nice tea out of it or a tincture out of it. They'd put drops in the eyes. Dilate the eyes, because in the Greco-Roman world, dilating eyes were alluring. I guess it was viewed better to have dilated eyes and to not be able to see anything or see the guys that were coming after you. I don't know. But that's Atropa belladonna. There's a mnemonic that's given in your book. It kind of goes dry as a bone, red as a beet, mad as a hatter, blind as a bat. Something like that. And that kind of gives us an idea of the effects of these guys. Dry as a bone. Now, when you think of being dry as a bone, what do you normally think might be askance? Sweating is a mess. Salivation could be a mess. Lacrimation could be a mess. So a decrease in secretions of all kinds. So dry as a bone, decreased secretions. Let's see, blind as a bat. So you can have several effects going on with the eye. What might they be? Mydriasis, paralysis of accommodation. Red as a beet. And I'll let you think about that one. How do you get red as a beet? Vasodilation, because body temperature went up. That's one theory. Atropine and some of its congeners produce what's called an atropine flush in the face and upper torso. Mechanism is, frankly, they say, unknown. Why the rest of the bod doesn't flush or not, who knows, but the red as a beet is this atropine flush. And then the final one was mad as a hatter. And what do they mean by that? Atropine gets into the central nervous system. It's a tertiary nitrogen alkaloid. It can cause hallucinations. There was a song many years ago about Jimson weed. Jimson weed contains scopolamine. And we have a case history about it. But it was by a guy named, Phil Stafford. Anybody know Phil Stafford? Getting ahead of myself. But it was called the Wildwood Weed. So when you get home sometime, go see if you can listen to the Wildwood Weed as they're sitting on a sack of seeds. But look at this case. We'll get another idea of the different kinds of effects anticholinergics do. Here we've got a 33-year-old woman. She came into the emergency room after being found in her apartment, bound and gagged. She was alert, but could remember only her name. Vital signs included a blood pressure of 150 over 100, pulse 115, respiration 16, rectal temperature 100. The patient showed no signs of trauma. Pupils were dilated to 8 millimeters and not reactive to light. Heart and lung sounds and chest x-ray were all normal. Examination of the abdomen indicated no bowel sounds. Abdominal muscles were relaxed and the abdomen distended. The remainder of the physical exam was unremarkable. So when you read through that list, What do you think of? Blood pressure, 150 over 100. Can you explain that? Okay, so the sympathetics are unopposed. That would make sense. Respirations at 16, is that normal, abnormal? It's normal. Temperature was 100. So it's elevated, so you got a hyperthermic response going on. Dilated pupils, again, that's anticholinergic effects. Lack of bowel sounds, and so forth. So when we think of muscarinic receptor agonist, if you just start at the eye and go down, what do you expect to see? Mydriasis, dry eye, spasm of accommodation, which one book calls cycloplasia. If you go into the lungs, you'd expect what? Closing, opening of the airway? So you'd expect dilation, or at least a lack of constriction. What about secretions? You'd expect them to dry up. If you get into the gut, an anticholinergic is going to slow things down. So decreased tone and motility, decreased secretions. Net effect is things don't work through the gut very well, so the patient could complain of feeling constipated. If we think of the urogenital tract, we can think of urinary retention. In fact, even an urgency to void because it's not filling or not emptying like normal. So those would be all effects that you'd expect from an anticholinergic. What happened to this little lady? They ended up giving her oral dextrose and water and activated charcoal. Now, why'd they give her activated charcoal? Turns out activated charcoal binds up lots of things. So it just adsorbs stuff. So something that's in the gastrointestinal tract can get mixed with the activated charcoal. It gets bound to the activated charcoal, and it eventually will pass out in the stool.
How can you tell this is anticholinergic rather than a
sympathetic agonist? Somebody want to try to answer that? The sympathetic does, but it tends to slow things down. So yeah, you could have some GI effects. You tend to not get a total absence of bowel sounds, which is kind of typical with the anticholinergics. You won't get the increase in body temperature, the atropine fever, or anticholinergic fever, which is fairly common with an anticholinergic. And even though sympathetics can help dilate the eye, you tend to not see that great a response. Okay. So at any rate, they thought she'd been drinking wine from a glass that was contaminated with an anticholinergic drug. The guy robbed her after drugging her. The source of scopolamine was never discovered. Where can you get scopolamine? If it had been scopolamine tablets, they are very bitter apparently. Having never had it, I don't know about that, but they're very bitter. And so it would have imparted a rather disagreeable taste to the wine, should have left a residue on the glass. But ophthalmic drops can contain 2.5 milligrams of scopolamine per mil. And in a separate toxicity report, a dose of 0.45 milligrams can cause intense psychoses that would persist for 4 days. So they decided this woman was poisoned with scopolamine. And knowing that, what might you do to treat her? They gave her some dextrose and water. What would that have done? She's clearly not hypoglycemic and not in a hypoglycemic-induced psychotic-type response or showing some strange behaviors. So what do we know about this drug, scopolamine? Well, there's a dose-response curve that one could look at. It looks something like this. And this is true basically of atropine, it's true of scopolamine, and everything else. When we think about it, what we're really dealing with here is looking at a dose response. Not all of these occur at the same dose. And so, years ago, atropine used to be used in almost every patient that went in for surgery because many of the inhalational anesthetics that were used at that time would cause secretions to be increased. And so in order to dry the mouth and things like that, you could use it as a pre-anesthetic agent. So a low dose of atropine or a low dose of scopolamine would inhibit salivary secretion. As you went higher and higher doses, though, you'd begin to get other effects. So as you can see, here is micturition speed, here's a change in heart rate, here's a change in accommodation. You can also, in fact, have an impact on gastric acid secretion. But the one thing that becomes obvious here is if you're trying to use anticholinergics to slow down the gut, let's say they got excessive diarrhea or something like that, you can use an anticholinergic to do that. But what are you going to get for side effects? The gut effects are out here. So obviously you're going to have the dry mouth, all secretions are going to dry up, you're going to have the urinary retention, you're going to have eye-related issues. So you can't pee and you can't see if you're using these drugs for anticholinergic effects on the gut. So not all of these effects that we see are necessarily induced at the same dose. All right. In terms of toxicity, toxic doses in the central nervous system start off typically with an excitatory type phase. They can then get into all kinds of psychotic behaviors and hallucinations. So a lot of the abuse of the anticholinergic plants, if you will, like smoking dried Jimson weed or crushing the seeds and taking those in, those are abused for the psychotic or the hallucinatory properties. So you get excitation, you get agitation, and then you get hallucinations. So there are a lot of different CNS-related effects of these drugs. You're going to decrease HCl secretion. So it would be a negative. Okay. What do we know about some agents and their uses and their adverse effects? There are too many of these agents to go through all of them. But when we think about their use, we could start off and just think, okay, in ophthalmology there's a big use. And what might that be? Dilate the eye, prevent accommodation, so the lens stays static, and you can then go in and do your ophthalmologic exam. So in terms of ophthalmology, the mydriasis and the cycloplasia then are desired effects. And so we've got a number of agents on the list, atropine, and then down a little bit further in the middle of that pile, you see agents that are listed as mydriatic, cyclopentolate, tropicamide, homatropine. Tropicamide is probably the widest used today, and that's because of its half-life. So when you go and you get your eyes dilated over at the optometry school, they put some drops in. They're putting some phenylephrine, which is an alpha agonist, and they're giving you some tropicamide, which is an anticholinergic, so that they can dilate the eye and prevent accommodation. The half-life of tropicamide tends to be on the order of 30 minutes to several hours. Some people don't clear up for longer than that. It's just a little slower in terms of its metabolism. I can't read for the rest of the night after an exam. So I go at 3 o'clock and then I'm a waste for the rest of the day. But some people respond much more quickly. In terms of these other agents, atropine in fact lasts 4 to 5 days when given topically. And the others are somewhere in between. So in ophthalmology then, you can use atropine, homatropine, tropicamide, cyclopentolate to produce mydriasis. Another use of these agents was, as it's shown here, as in peptic ulcer disease, propanthiolene is the primary agent that's used to treat peptic ulcer. We've learned a lot over the years about how ulcers are formed and how they are treated. The anticholinergic drugs were a mainstay in the 70s because no one knew what was going on. And then as time went on, unless you've got somebody that's refractory to proton pump inhibitors and other things, then propanthiolene is you know, way down at the end in terms of a drug that would be used. Hyperactive or irritable bowel syndrome. Propanthiolene is also useful here, in the sense that the anticholinergics will slow down the gut. And so if you've got somebody with hyperactive bowel syndrome, it's a nice drug. But if you remember the dose response curves that I showed you, if you're going to slow down the gut, the patient's going to have eye problems, they're going to have secretion-related deficits, and so there are significant side effects associated with it. What about obstructive lung disorders? There's one on the list, ipratropium. It's the third one from the bottom. There's a new one out, came out a couple of years ago, called tiotropium or Spiriva. What are these guys doing? They're basically preventing the parasympathetic innervation of the bronchial smooth muscles, so they're preventing bronchoconstriction. And in spasms of the bronchial smooth muscle, you tend to get constrictive type responses. Patients that are asthmatic tend to have a hyperactive airway, so itsy-bitsy little triggers produce bigger contractions, and so you need to have something in there to prevent the contractions from going. And so ipratropium is used as a bronchodilator, or tiotropium. And we'll talk more about tiotropium when we do asthma. Okay, as we go down the list now, we've got symptomatic relief of acute rhinitis. What's rhinitis? Runny nose, so you can dry it up a little bit. Antidote for cholinomimetic overdose or mushroom poisoning. So if you've got a mushroom that's all muscarinic, you can use an anti-muscarinic to help make the patient more comfortable, and so forth. The next one on the list is a hyperactive carotid sinus reflex. This is, or in other words, a sinus bradycardia after an MI. So in this situation, things are too slow. You want to prevent excess cholinergic drive to the heart. So you just give it an anticholinergic. And so it can work in a bradycardic type situation. The anti-Parkinsonism drugs, I didn't give you too many of them. There are three that are listed in your book. Benztropine is probably the oldest one that's been around. Trihexyphenidyl and biperidin. I don't think you need to worry about them right now because you're going to get them in the CNS block when we talk about all the drugs that are used in Parkinsonism. You got enough drugs on this list already. So just remember that anticholinergics have an effect or have a usefulness in the treatment of Parkinsonism. And probably the biggest use of this class of drugs is in the treatment of motion sickness. Scopolamine, you can get transdermal patches. They go right behind the ear. And for those people who have ever used them, they swear by them. Anybody in here used them? One person. You like them? Having not had seasickness or stuff like that, I never tried them, so I can't tell you anything about them. Okay, mechanism. What are these guys doing? Every one of the drugs in that list is a direct binder to the receptor. So it can bind the receptor, prevent the agonist from binding, and that's how it produces its blockade. So it's a direct-acting blocking drug. All right. The grocery list, yes, sir.
What was the receptor type in the
ganglia? It's an M1 receptor.
So is it targeting
asynaptic and postsynaptic? M1, well, we'll get to that in a second when we do ganglionic. There's only one available M1 receptor blocker in the United States. It's pyrenzapine. Looks like I didn't even put it on the list. Oh yeah, there it is. Slows gastric emptying. Okay. So that's really the only one that's a selective M1 blocker. Yes? These are all reversible blockers. So they compete with the agonist for binding to the receptor. So the prototype drug in the class is atropine. The second most common drug in the class is scopolamine. And then when you get into specifics, you can get into the other agents. The last couple of agents on the list are widely used in geriatric populations to control incontinence: oxybutynin or ditropan, tolteridine or detrol. And you would think, okay, that just makes them a little bit harder to pee so they don't lose it during incontinence. Side effects. What would anticholinergics do? So it's a direct extension of their pharmacology. So you should be able to predict them, right? Dry as a bone, red as a beet. Blind as a bat. There's one more. Mad as a hatter. Okay. So when we think about it, I've got a list here. Xerostomia, which is just dry mouth. Cycloplegia. You've got accommodative disorders. Photophobia. The eye is widely dilated, so bright lights are not pleasurable. CNS stimulation can occur. Or depression. It used to be thought that atropine always caused CNS depression. Scopolamine was always a stimulant. So for years, over-the-counter sleep aids had a little bit of atropine in them. Then they realized that atropine could, in fact, cause some stimulation, and so they got taken out. So you can get both CNS stimulation followed by typically depression. How can you precipitate an acute glaucoma attack? Okay, so if you think of just the anatomy, you've got normal angle glaucoma. Miotics are useful in altering the structure of that trabecular meshwork so that percolation of fluid through it would continue at a normal rate. If you block that response, fluid doesn't leave the anterior chamber as well. Pressures go up. Okay. So anhidrosis contributes to the atropine fever. So remember that body temperature can go up in these guys. In fact, it can go up high enough to elicit heat stroke. This is especially a problem in infants where body temperature regulation is not as good as it would be once they're a little bit older. Or it could be a problem in somebody who's outside in hot temperatures. So anhidrosis can give the atropine fever. We've got heat stroke, which could follow urinary retention and constipation. So the only other weird thing that atropine does is the atropine flush. Remember, red as a beet. So any questions on anticholinergics? I know I've blasted through them in a hurry. But again, if you just think back to that table, page 7, and know where muscarinic receptors are in end organs and think about blocking that site, you can predict what the action is, and then based on predicting the action, you can then think about, oh, well, this could be useful for this, and typical side effects would be. Okay? So you got to get really comfortable with that chart. Just as a piece of trivia that you don't want to remember, but it turns out that patients with Alzheimer's type dementia are more sensitive to anticholinergic drugs than the native population, so you can use about 1/100th of the dose of tropicamide to get full mydriasis. And it's about 95% correlation between low-dose responders and Alzheimer's disease. And what I don't understand is why most people don't try this in a patient that they think is showing dementia. Because the correlation seems to be there, and if a practitioner has a patient come in and the family's complaining they're losing it, you could actually give them the low dose of tropicamide, see if you get the full mydriasis, and if you do, then you could then start them out on appropriate therapy for Alzheimer's.
Is it just the mydriasis, or do they have exaggerated responses?
Well, you normally just dose it ocularly and look for that response. But at any rate, that's what the ophthalmology literature talks about, but it's really not used diagnostically much, and I don't know why. Okay. Any questions?
Yeah, we have a question. You meant like, can you make somebody 10 cardiac if you get an Alzheimer's patient? Like you have to dose it 1/100th every time so they don't get side effects.
Oh, I see what you're saying. The study that was done with tropicamide. It was done with oral, with only ocular dosing, top-oc dosing. And in that particular case, they've got a correlation in patients that was positive. And the article does not discuss major problems with side effects, other than visual. Okay. Somebody read.
How early on did the study say how early on in Alzheimer's that you can see that effect?
Most of the patients that were in that study were beginning to show signs of dementia. So they had I can't remember now. It was a huge age range, 25 plus years, seems to me. Yeah. Okay. When we think of ganglionic blockers and ganglionic neurotransmission, we get into a little more complications. These complications are also explainable knowing what happens through certain receptor types. And so, again, you got to know which side of the system is dominant and then what the effects of hitting certain receptor types might be. Way back in the 50s, one of the guys in England that was studying the autonomic nervous system, and in fact who gave an awful lot of the information, wrote a story about the hexamethonium man. Now, hexamethonium was kind of the experimental ganglionic blocker. And this is kind of an interesting story. We need somebody who's got a good British accent. Who can read in a British accent? I can't, but Tyler's name's been mentioned. Well, then just read it in your normal voice, please. Excellent. All right. Now let's pick this apart. He's a pink-complexioned person except when he has stood in a queue for a long time, when he may get pale and faint. Why is he getting pale and faint standing? So venous return is not what it should be. So you've got venous pooling. His handshake is warm and dry. So sympathetics are going to cause some sweating. You block that response. You have dry skin. Your rudest story won't make him blush. So you don't have a flushing response. Let's see. You like that part about the corsets? Okay. So to compress a splanchnic vascular pool. See, that's really most of the problem here. Is the venous pooling, blood's not getting back to where it really needs to be. What about the eye? Can you explain those responses? He's long-sighted. So he can't accommodate to read. He's photophobic, blinded by bright light. Now, why do you think he's got red eyes? So lack of secretions could be just an irritation response. Vasodilation. And, of course, he may be up all night, too. Who knows? Let's see. He always behaves like a gentleman and never belches or hiccups. Oh, yeah, he does not have chilblains. What are chilblains? Anybody got any idea? You don't know. Inflammation of the hands and feet caused by exposure to cold and moisture. So chilblains, inflammation of hands and feet caused by exposure to cold and moisture. Not something we use in the American English language very often. Let's see, well, that's not so bad. He's not going to have peptic ulcer disease. He's not going to have hypertension. He never feels hunger pain. His stomach never rumbles. He gets constipated, so it's blocked parasympathetic drive to the gut. His intake of liquid paraffin, people used to take a lot of paraffin to try to help promote normal GI function and overcome constipation. Let's see. He will suffer from retention of urine and impotence, but frequency, the need to go, precipitancy, and strangury will not worry him. Strangury, painful drop by drop urination. So this is an interesting situation. When we think about all the receptors that are involved, most of the effects that we want to think about are going to be those that are active through the ganglionic the ganglionic nicotinic receptor. This ganglionic nicotinic receptor is responsible for excitatory postsynaptic potentials. If the excitatory postsynaptic potential is big enough to generate an action potential, then you see the spike. So the nicotinic receptor agonists are triggering an influx of sodium. The sodium influx, if it's high enough, is going to trigger what? Depolarization, which is now a change in which current's going up? What's the spike? What channels? So, got wide open sodium channels, potassium channels, eventually calcium channels. You got your action potential, then what happens to membrane potential as we go on? You can have binding to an M2 receptor, which produces an inhibitory type response. You can have binding to M1 receptors, which can produce a slow EPSP. And of course, you've got the vascular system, which is going to be helping to bring nutrients to the tissue and take waste products away. But in that will be a collections of peptides, vasoactive intestinal peptide, bradykinin, angiotensin II, things of that nature. And these things can cause a late EPSP, or excitatory postsynaptic potential. So all of these things, as you can see, can modulate the different ion channels that are important in maintaining membrane potential. The other thing that's really not shown in this particular figure, but we could draw in another cell here if we wanted to, and this cell could be called, oh, it's got different names, but most people just call it a SIF cell, a small, intensely fluorescent cell, because if you hit it with dye, it fluoresces. But it turns out that this is more of a catecholamine-secreting neuron. And so you get binding then to, on this postganglionic axon, either dopamine receptors or alpha receptors. And these tend to also contribute to an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. Why do we go through all this? Sometimes when we try to explain certain effects of classes of drugs, it'll be because they're affecting these other responses. and they'll modulate what you're seeing. And it'll be, things will make sense once we've gotten all the way through the block of material. Normally, when we think of a nicotinic receptor agonist, it's going to produce the action potential, and it's going to produce whatever you're measuring downstream in terms of the end organ. So if we think about that, if you think about the arteriolar beds, what's the primary receptor that would be downstream on this postganglionic neuron? Alpha 1. Now, if you bind to the alpha 1 with norepinephrine, what do you get? Constriction. If you get constriction, what happens to blood pressure? Goes up. If we think about the venous beds, the same situation is there. You stimulate this postganglionic sympathetic neuron, then you're going to release norepinephrine. The norepinephrine is going to bind to the alpha 1 receptor to produce vasoconstriction. If you don't do that, if you prevent transmission through the system, you don't get contraction of the vascular beds. And then what happens? You get venous pooling like we had in our case. Now, the trouble with the big veins is they've got huge capacitance. They can balloon out really nicely and hold a lot of blood. So venous pooling can be a big problem. You get inadequate return to the heart. Blood pressure is going to drop. Cardiac output is going to go down. Lots of things can happen. So normally, ganglionic transmission is going to try to keep some degree of constriction always in the venous system. Let's see, what else can we think about? We could talk about the heart itself. If you stimulate through this system, what do you expect to see downstream? If you stimulate ganglionic transmission, you stimulate this axon, you're going to release let's back up, because now you're really stewing. You got two sides of the system. You got ganglionic transmission. So what is the postganglionic neuron that's going to cause the biggest response in the heart? Which side dominates? Parasympathetic dominates. So under normal conditions, heart rate is less than the intrinsic rate, because the parasympathetics are turned on. So if you stimulate ganglionic transmission, both sides, which side's going to dominate? The parasympathetic side. And the parasympathetic side's going to slow things down. If you give a ganglionic blocking drug that prevents transmission through the system, and heart rate's going to go up because you're preventing the parasympathetic side from functioning. It may only rise to 100. It may keep on going depending on what's happening on the other side. What else can we think about? We can think about the gut. So normally when you stimulate the ganglia, again, you're stimulating both sides. So you've got parasympathetic and you've got sympathetic. Which side normally dominates? It's parasympathetic. So if you stimulate ganglionic transmission, you're going to end up, at this case, releasing neurotransmitter, acetylcholine. It's going to bind to M3 receptor, and it's going to speed up the gut. So normally the gut is under parasympathetic dominance. So if you stimulate ganglionic transmission, you stimulate the parasympathetic system dominantly and you speed things up. If you block that transmission here, then you're going to prevent the GI system from working and going into overdrive. You can have the same thinking in the bladder. So normally the bladder is under parasympathetic dominance. When you need to go, what happens if you stimulate through the system? Micturate, you really go, okay. But if retention is what's happening, which means the sympathetic side now is acting as the dominant side, then you get urinary retention. So thinking about the system, thinking about what's happening as you push through the system can help you to understand this ganglionic transmission business a little bit more. The most important thing to remember, really, is on the bottom of page 21, where it talks about different sites of action, which side dominates, and then the effect of what ganglionic blockade would be. And we'll come back and pick that up in a bit. Any questions? Well, let's keep going. What about the ganglionic agonists and antagonists? What can we use them for? So there on page 21 in the middle, we've got a list of therapeutic uses for ganglionic blocking drugs. You can control hypertensive cardiovascular emergencies. It used to be that the ganglionic blocking drugs were the drugs of choice in diseases such as a dissecting aortic aneurysm or any kind of a hypertensive crisis. The problem with the ganglionic blocking drugs is they act everywhere. And so it turns out there are vasodilators that can produce a controlled hypertension that are a little easier to control. And we'll talk about these in a couple of weeks, but nitroprusside being one of them. But you can still see the use of these drugs in hypertensive crises. Many of your plastic surgeons can use the ganglionic blocking drugs to promote a strong degree of hypotension to help reduce blood loss in terms of extensive skin dissection. And some neurosurgeons like to use it as well to produce a bloodless field when they're doing their surgeries. The third therapeutic use on there is called autonomic hyperreflexia. This is an interesting situation. In autonomic hyperreflexia, about 85% of the patients that have spinal cord injuries will end up with hyperactive autonomic type function. So blood pressure goes up, heart rate goes down, they have sweating, flushing, headaches, and all of this predisposes them to MIs and cerebrovascular accidents. So autonomic hyperreflexia, about 85% of the patients with spinal cord injuries have it. What happens is, and how do you get the increase in blood pressure that's problematic? One of the triggers, it turns out, is a full bladder. And the full bladder tries to tell the brain the bladder's full and it's time to empty. But because of the spinal cord injury, that information doesn't get up into the brain. And so you set up local reflex arcs in the pelvic region, and you end up then getting excessive sympathetic discharge to the pelvic vasculature, causing rises in blood pressure. So that's a typical trigger, full bladder. Local reflex arc, increasing sympathetic discharge to the vasculature, raising blood pressure. And so one of the groups of drugs that can be used then to prevent this autonomic hyperreflexia would be your ganglionic blocking drugs. You can also use an alpha blocker to prevent the vasoconstriction as well. But autonomic hyperreflexia then. Then the final list on there is acute pulmonary edema to reduce pulmonary vascular resistance. So if you think about it, these guys are going to lower blood pressure. They can reduce preload nicely. You can also do that with a beta 2 agonist. So there are cleaner drugs that are more selective available, but there is some use. If you turn over to the next page, you end up seeing a listing of some drugs. I've got nicotine on the list as a nicotinic agonist. Anybody that's abused or used, I should say, tobacco-related products knows that tobacco is a stimulant to the GI tract, a stimulant to the central nervous system, stimulant to the cardiovascular system. So obviously, if you're using nicotine to stimulate the ganglia, then you end up increasing anything that ganglionic transmission would increase. Nicotine is also interesting from the standpoint that if you give too high a dose, you actually can get nicotinic receptor blockade. But most people then that would use nicotine in the form of tobacco-related products ends up having it as a stimulant. There is a push both in this country and elsewhere in the world to use nicotine as a pesticide. Turns out that it's a great pesticide. What do you think the problem with the pesticide is, though? If you take tobacco and you extract the nicotine out of it, so the tobacco manufacturers or growing industries trying to promote nicotine as a pesticide. The problem is it's acute toxicity to the person doing the applying. You get it sprayed on yourself, it's going to get absorbed, and in the doses that you would absorb, it will cause stimulation. But if you get too much or you would happen to drink the stuff, it's nasty. So this summer, with the drought and everything, a lot of people have been complaining about white flies on all their plants and things like that. So if you take some tobacco and you leave it in water for a period of, say, 4 to 5 hours, you can then strain out the tobacco, put it in a spray bottle, and go spray your plants, and it'll kill those white flies nicely. But if you drink what's in that bottle, you may not need to worry about those white flies anymore. So the use of nicotine as a pesticide is severely limited by its acute toxicity to the human being that's trying to apply it as a pesticide. So nicotine is kind of weird. Normally it's a stimulant, but then it can become a blocker. The second group of drugs there are nicotinic receptor blockers. That's all they do. Hexamethonium, we read about. It's classical, experimental, not used for anything clinically. The other two drugs, I think the only one that's available in the United States right now is mecamelamine or inversine. Trimethaphane is in Europe. But I'm not sure if it's still sold in the United States. What do we know about mecamelamine? It's different from many of the others. It is a tertiary amine. It can cross the blood-brain barrier and get into the central nervous system. It tends to be sold as either IV use or in tablets. 2.5 milligram tablets. It has an LD50 of about 70 milligrams per kilogram. So if somebody were to swallow their bottle, you know, they'd be gone. So the lethality curve is really short for these guys. So a narrow therapeutic window, therapeutic index. It's about 75. The number is not important. The fact of the matter is if you got a month's supply of this stuff for autonomic hyperreflexia, you could knock yourself out forever. So it is a concern. Okay. Side effects. We know these guys do lots of things, so you should be able to predict these. So if we say visual disturbances, what visual disturbances? Photophobia, so you'd have an aversion to bright light. What else? So you'd have some accommodative problem. So you could say cycloplasia and photophobia. We got listed next, xerostomia, but besides dry mouth, what else could you be drying up? Tears. You could be drying bronchial secretions. You could be drying up the GI tract. We can talk about urinary retention. So we get prevention of the contraction of the detrusor muscle. You don't get relaxation of the trigone. We could talk about impotence. You can have effects on both sides, muscarinic receptor mediated erection or alpha mediated ejaculation. CNS stimulation followed by depression, marked hypotension, including postural hypotension. So blood pressure can come down as well. Is the lack of the reflex needed to keep blood pressure normal when you go from laying down to sitting up or standing up. So you get both just a drop in pressure as well as postural hypotension. And you can get what's called paralytic ileus, which leads to constipation. So paralysis of the gut, if you will, paralytic ileus. So those are your ganglionic blocking drugs. The main one to remember in all of this is mecamelamine. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, good. Well, now we can go forward and think about what happens at the neuromuscular junction. The good news is you don't have to know all this stuff, because pharmacologically we don't play with a lot of it. But nevertheless, the neuromuscular junction is a very complicated system, and pharmacologically we can manipulate the system at almost every level of its function. You can affect the action potential. Tetrodotoxin is found in puffer fish. Batraxotoxin is found in South American frogs. So you can get into things that affect the nerve action potential. We've got botulinum toxin, hemicolinium, that affect acetylcholine release. We've got lots of things, the curare alkaloids or tubocurarine we'll talk about, has an impact here on depolarization. Cholinesterase inhibitors, of course, allow the acetylcholine to stay around longer, so that can have an impact then on neuromuscular transmission. And as you can see, the list goes on and on and on. We'll talk about the curare alkaloid, succinylcholine, and dantrolene as we go through today. So you can affect everything from the nerve action potential to calcium storage within the muscle itself. We've got a case at the bottom of the page, which kind of talks about what can happen. This is a genetic defect. This was a 3-month-old that was admitted for a pylorotomy. He was given some anesthesia, thiopental maintained with isoflurane, and he was given 6 milligrams of succinylcholine IV. The operation was completed, no problems, but when they tried to pull him off a respirator, he remained apneic and flaccid, so controlled ventilation was required and continued. He was tested for residual neuromuscular block without response. 1 hour later, he still showed no change. And so then they hit him with cholinesterase P bearing, which is a preparation that's available to give to people who don't have enough plasma cholinesterase. So The genetic anomaly here is found in one in about 2,500 patients, and they don't have adequate levels of serum cholinesterase. And so when you give them something like succinylcholine, they basically don't breathe for a long, long time. So what's the biggest problem with neuromuscular junction inhibition? You inhibit the muscles enough until nothing happens and they stop breathing. Okay. So normal contraction. How do we get it? You got to have acetylcholine around. The acetylcholine binds to the neuromuscular nicotinic receptor. That triggers a whole lot of responses. The biggest one, though, is calcium. And what does the calcium do? We're talking muscles now. Get big. You guys are getting way, muscle contraction. Okay. So what's muscle contraction? Actin and myosin filaments sliding around. Calcium's required for that. So normally then, acetylcholine's required. Let's say you have normal amounts of acetylcholine, then the muscle fires when it's triggered. It goes back to the resting state. But let's say you got too much acetylcholine, what happens? You go from a progression of firing to asynchronous firing to fasciculations to paralysis. It never has a chance to repolarize. So you can get a whole gradation of responses dealing with too much acetylcholine, and you can affect that by manipulating the system. Therapeutic uses. Why would you want to mess up the system? Well, the first one there is listed as muscle relaxation during anesthesia and surgery. It turns out that if you want to do surgery and you want the anesthetic to relax the muscle, you're going to use a whale of a lot more anesthetic. You're going to knock the patient much further down, much deeper anesthesia, in order to get muscle relaxation. If you give a muscle relaxant, on the other hand, you can use much less anesthetic, which would be much less risk to the patient, and still get the relaxation needed to do your cutting. Another area has to do with electroconvulsive shock therapy. When people get shocked for say depression and things like that, everything then goes into contractions. You can actually fracture bones and cause dislocations and things like that. So you turn the system off by giving a skeletal muscle relaxant, and that prevents the dislocations and fractures. Another use for these drugs is in the treatment of muscle spasms from endoscopy or bronchoscopy. So you know the patient's coming in, they're going to have a procedure, you can give them a muscle relaxant so that you don't have muscle spasms while you're passing the tube down. So those are just some things that you could do. When we think about neuromuscular blockade, you might think all muscles react the same, but do they? Yes, sir. The muscles can't contract. So if you zap them, you get massive muscle contractions, and so joints get broken, bones get broken, dislocations can occur. So not all muscle groups respond the same. That's the good news. So when you think about that, what might be affected first? Small muscles, so muscles of the hands, the feet, the mouth. So your smaller muscle groups are affected first. You then get into head and neck. You can get into then the abdomen and the extremities. But the very last muscles that are affected by these muscle relaxants are the diaphragm, internal, and external intercostals. So there is a graded response in terms of muscle groups. So you run low doses affect facial, small muscles of hands, feet, so to speak. Higher doses would be needed to get into larger muscles of the head and neck. Higher doses to get into the abdomen and the extremities. And even higher doses to get to the respiratory muscles. So that's the good news. You can paralyze muscle without compromising respiration if you choose your doses appropriately. There are two primary mechanisms that one can think about. And drugs are often listed as depolarizing or non-depolarizing muscle relaxants. So what are we talking about here? Well, let's consider first a non-depolarizing situation. An example of that would be tubocurarine. So what does it do? It's a non-depolarizing blocker. It binds to the receptor. The receptor stays closed. It doesn't activate. It's simply a competitive blocker. So it doesn't depolarize the muscle at all. It just competes with acetylcholine for binding to the receptor site. Most of the agents that we use today are of the non-depolarizing type. The flip side is an agent like succinylcholine, which is called a depolarizing blocker. And in a depolarizing blocker sense, you can end up opening the channel and you keep it open. So what happens? With initial therapy, you expect some contraction, but with the continued presence of the drug at the active site, it never leaves the receptor. Well, it does leave because this is competitive. But it'll stay on it. It'll keep the muscle polarized so it can't contract again. So it's once depolarized, it stays depolarized and won't repolarize until the drug wears off.
So do you have to get polarizing agents?
Say that again. Yes.
Do you get that with the non-depolarizing?
No. Okay. So mechanistically, they can simply be competitive blockers of the acetylcholine and not depolarize the system, or they can depolarize it and then prevent repolarization from occurring. So two different mechanisms. For those who love tables, there's a table at the bottom of that page. And on the next page, there's kind of four agents and some discussion about the agents. One of the things that I want you to notice is that with regard to all of these derivatives that are here, they don't just act on skeletal muscle. So they act other places, or they have the ability to act other places. Some much more significantly than others. And some have minimal actions at typical therapeutic doses. All of these up above, succinylcholine, are non-depolarizing drugs, succinylcholine being a depolarizer. The other thing that's important is that these guys, except for succinylcholine, are all quaternary amines. So when you think about quaternary amines, then they're going to have minimal CNS effects. The prototype for the class is called tubocurarine. So tubocurarine, as you can see here, it causes weak blockade on autonomic ganglia and a moderate release of histamine. So you might say, okay, tubocurarine is kind of dirty because it has lots of other effects as well. If we think first of histamine release, what kinds of negatives do you think are associated with that? Histamine can cause blood pressure to go down, and that's a big concern. So it's a vasodilator. It can also cause an increase in secretions. If it causes an increase in secretions, what are you going to do to prevent it? An anticholinergic. So you'd give some atropine. So even though it has that property, you can control it. So the histamine then, vasodilators, it also causes bronchoconstriction and an increase in secretions. The other action that we talk about is this effect on autonomic ganglia. So if it's a ganglionic blocker, what would you expect to happen with blood pressure? It should go down. So now you got two things that are helping knock blood pressure down. So if you're the anesthesiologist and you're choosing to use tubocurarine, you're going to be watching blood pressure very, very closely. So ganglionic blockade, decreased blood pressure, decreased venous return to the heart because of vasodilation and venous pooling. So that's tubocurarine. Another drug that we can talk about is this one down here. It's called vecuronium. You can see it's pretty clean all the way across. So a lot of people like vecuronium. Again, it's a competitive nicotinic receptor blocker, short acting. I didn't mention this. Tubocurarine can act 30 minutes to, say, an hour. Vecuronium acts probably 20 minutes to 40 minutes, so it's a little bit shorter in terms of duration. Vecuronium, again, has no effects in these other sites, so it's a cleaner drug. The third agent that I've kind of singled out is this mevacurium. As you can see, no effects on the autonomic ganglia, no effects on cardiac muscarinic receptors, but it has a slight effect in terms of histamine release. Mevacurium has an ultra-short onset. You can get muscle relaxation in about 2 minutes of injection, and it lasts the shortest. So it lasts, say, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. So mevacurium, little differences in the set of properties, but ultra-short acting. Last time I checked, mevacurium was widely used at Bloomington Hospital. So the anesthesiologists there like that. They also use a lot of vecuronium. Okay. The fourth drug that I kind of single out is succinylcholine. Notice that it stimulates autonomic ganglia. It stimulates muscarinic receptors in the heart, and it has some slight histamine release of properties. So when you think about succinylcholine, it's going to do a lot of other things. So what's the effect of stimulating autonomic ganglia? So blood pressure is going to go up. If you think about cardiac muscarinic receptors, what's going to happen there? So you'd think, okay, heart rate could go down. Let's see, what else can succinylcholine do? Decrease heart rate. We can have an increase in blood pressure. If we get a lot of effect on muscarinics, though, what can happen to blood pressure? Muscarinics. So you can have a direct action on muscarinic receptors in the vascular smooth muscle. Releases this endothelin relaxing factor, which is nitric oxide, primarily. John. You can have mixed bag effects on blood pressure, depending on dose with succinylcholine. Yes, sir.
We're learning how to do intubation drugs and stuff in medicine, and Dr. Stone and Dr. Slaughter both said that the majority of the ER docs use succinylcholine to intubate. I'm trying to figure out why, with the side effects, they wouldn't use Vecuronium fast.
Real short onset. Well, you here to here, they're about here to here. They're similar in terms of their onset and their durations. Probably because they've had a lot more experience with this. There, succinylcholine has another negative effect, and that is it causes a release of serum potassium. It raises serum potassium. So succinylcholine is probably the dirtiest drug of the bunch, but it's widely used. Some people argue, well, you should screen patients to see if they have the lack of the serum cholinesterase, you know, and then others say, well, it's not worth spending the money to do the screen because you've got an antidote that's readily available. You just keep that on hand, and if the patient doesn't come out like you expect, you give them some of that preparation, and within a short period of time, they're back to normal. So, succinylcholine. You often can see fasciculations with onset of therapy before you get the paralysis. Okay. Can't read my handwriting. Apparently it increases potassium above 7. Milliequivalent. So you can get a large increase in potassium here. You can see there are a lot of other agents out there, and they all have mixtures of these properties, and they have differences in pharmacokinetic spectrum. And so different people have different likes and dislikes. I think one of the longer acting ones is this doxycurium, which tends to last, oh, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 hours. Whereas a lot of these others are an hour to less than an hour.
You said that it stimulates the autonomic ganglia,
So sometimes you may get a decrease in heart rate. Sometimes you may get an increase in heart rate with succinylcholine. Watch your patient. It's going to be a function of effects on heart rate. It's going to be a function of effects on blood pressure and how the blood pressure change is responded to by the body. I'll explain it to David later. That's all right. So blood pressure changes. Okay, any other questions? Yes, no, maybe so. Okay, so the point here is there are a lot of drugs available to cause muscle relaxation. Different places have different ones that they prefer to use. Once you get used to it, you just can work with it. If you know it's going to knock blood pressure down, you can always just watch for that. You can adjust the dose accordingly. Again, most of these agents are of short duration, so you control their duration of action by how often you supplement. So you give them a starting dose and then you supplement as needed to keep the relaxation down. The other thing that sometimes happens is people start surgery. They give the muscle relaxation until they get through the muscle layer, say through the abdomen, so that they can do some kind of abdominal surgery, or through the thorax to do the thoracic surgery, and then they back off and they leave the muscle relaxant to just get washed out by the body. When they get ready to close the patient at the end of the operation, they might supplement back with muscle relaxation because they're affecting those muscles as they go to stitch them back together. So you don't keep the patient on these drugs the whole time if you're doing a long surgery. So there are lots of ways of manipulating how you're working with them, which is why you can use such a muddy drug as succinylcholine and it still be, you know, it's efficacious, it does what you want it to, it's short acting, and you can control it. You, the anesthesiologist, if that's what you become, can control it by how you use it. Okay, questions? Clear as mud. Okay. Next year, no class on Labor Day. Yes. Stupid university. Okay.